So the publisher is right down the street, MIT Press, of the book, and without even either asking me or telling me, decided that you all are so worthy that they gave the books to the Peace Action, and the Peace Action is trying to raise a little money by selling them. So you all should get the book. Even if it's not a good book, at least you're supporting the organizations that have sponsored this important discussion. So I'm going to lay out just a basic framework that I think is a viable path for climate stabilization. And it's important that we talk about real viable paths for stabilization. I want to first cite a news story that came out last week. The news stories that were, it was all over the press, is based on this new report that was issued last week, of which the lead author was Sir Robert Watson, the former chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a UN-based organization that's independent, and it is basically the clearinghouse for all the research on climate change. I myself, not being a climate scientist, I rely heavily on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for setting the parameters of the kind of economics work that I do. Anyway, so this is just a short report that was issued last week, and the Professor Watson comments as follows. With respect to the Paris December 2015 agreement, which was a historic breakthrough in that it was the first time that 169 countries signed this agreement that acknowledged climate change was for real and that serious action needed to be taken. So far, so good. That was what was achieved in Paris. But here's Watson commenting on the pledges that were achieved in Paris. The pledges are not going to even get close. Okay, if your governments of the world are really serious, you're going to have to do way, way more than you committed to in Paris. Okay, so this is news as of last week. And so basically, that I want to show you, first of all, that even with Paris, we are clearly, if you believe climate science, and are there anybody here as a climate scientist? It's not me, but I take what they say seriously. I don't see what choice we have. We can talk about that later. Even if they're wrong, what choice do we have but to take it seriously? We can get into that later. But anyway, what are we looking at? So we're looking at CO2 emissions in the world, global CO2 emissions today, which are the first bar, which is around 32 billion tons of CO2 emission per year. Now, what are those other bars? These are alternative projections for CO2 emissions as of 2035. So right now we're at 32 billion tons. The baseline case of the International Energy Agency, which is another big research and clearinghouse institution in Paris, I'll give you another set of numbers in a minute from the US Energy Department. But anyway, so they say that under their baseline, if the world proceeds more or less as we are now, by 2035 we will go up from 32 billion tons to 43 billion tons. Okay, that's their baseline projection. Then they have this other scenario, which they call, quote, new policies. And the new policy scenario corresponds pretty closely with what was agreed to in Paris. Okay? So the breakthrough in Paris is as follows, that by 2035, instead of having 43 billion tons, we're still going to go up because we're 32 billion tons, but we're only going to go up to 37 billion tons. Okay? That's the Paris, roughly the Paris scenario. Now, what the IPCC is saying, and this reflects what Professor Watson, his sense of alarm, what they're saying that in order to have a reasonable chance to stabilize the climate at 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, by 2035, and you know, if you actually read their documents, they never pinpoint one number, but so I'm trying to give a simple summary. I think it's a fair summary. They're saying we need to be at 20 billion tons. At 20 billion tons. Right now we're at 32 billion tons. If the world proceeds like we are, we'll be at 43. If we do the Paris agreements, we'll be at 37. But we need to be at 20. So roughly speaking, if more or less what happens out of Paris, and by the way, the Paris agreement, they were not binding pledges. They were aspirational. There was no recourse for anyone that breaks their pledge. So, but even if everybody does what they say they're going to do, we're going to be at 37 billion tons or thereabouts. We need to be at 20. So this is why this sense of alarm coming out of this Professor Watson. Yeah. Per year.
Of fossil fuel.
Of CO2.
Of fossil fuel emissions.
Yeah, so.
All fossil.
So it's not all greenhouse gas. It's not all. So CO2 is about 70% of all greenhouse gas emissions. So.
Right, but anthropogenic or total?
These are all total emissions.
Including
these are all just CO2. Yeah, this is just CO2, but it does not include other greenhouse gas emissions.
Does it include animal agriculture? Because that's a huge...
Right, it does not include that.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of policy
things
to follow.
No, I agree with you.
So
but
they don't include that there.
So I'm going to just talk about energy, emissions from energy, which, depending on how you measure it, it constitutes about 70% of all greenhouse gas emissions. But yeah, you'd have to tell another story about agriculture, and especially methane methane is not part of the CO2 emissions, but it is part of energy in that you get methane leakages out of production of fossil fracking for natural gas. But Yeah. I completely agree with you. Totally agree. It's just not what I'm going to focus on. I'm going to focus on energy. And this is basically, this is from the U.S. Department of Energy. And I pulled this off of their website this morning. So just in case you thought that the numbers that I was giving you from last year's study of the International Energy Agency in Paris, as though maybe it's out of date because Paris has changed everything. So this is what we get from the Department of Energy today, and what we're looking at are the OECD is the basically the rich countries, the U.S., Western Europe, Japan, South Korea, a couple other countries. So those, what we see, the black line is showing us that emissions within the OECD from roughly 2012 to the present are roughly stable, okay, increasing but only slightly at around 17 billion tons. And but the non-OECD, which is China, India, Indonesia, Brazil, everybody else, is going up quite sharply from about 20 to 30. And we're still back at about 40 billion tons of CO2 emissions. So this is another source. Now, you could say, oh, the OECD is doing well, but stabilizing isn't good enough. We can't just maintain our current level. We need an absolute contraction. Yeah, sure.
Those emission numbers, is there data somewhere that distinguishes between transportation versus industrial production?
No, it's all sources of CO2.
You know, Asia goes up, developing countries could be because industry is being outsourced there.
Yeah, that's certainly part of the story. Well, they're also growing, you know, they're growing and they're using fossil fuels. I mean, China's pledge that was hailed, China's pledge in Paris was that they would stabilize emissions as of 2030. So, you know, this is a country that is, you know, 1.3 billion people and it's growing, you know, so the growth is slowed down. It's still 6.5-7% a year. And if you do that on the basis of fossil fuels, of course, you're going to get this rapid increase in emissions. So this is the story. And so, yes, you know, when I say we're courting ecological disaster, it's pretty straightforward what that refers to. Okay, so what do we do about it? I argue in this book and other things, in fact, Paul, who invited me, actually, you read that huge, yeah, that was amazing that you read. You're probably the only person that read it. The book tries to distill from this very long study and another couple long, very long studies. But anyway, the basic program is very straightforward, very simple. So it basically entails, in my view, investments in two areas: raising efficiency and clean renewable energy. Okay? And that's it. Now, what's the scale at which we do it? Well, the scale has to be large, but when I say large, what I mean is that we should be devoting on the order of 1.5 to 2% of global GDP per year, every year, in new investments in energy efficiency, to raise energy efficiency standards, and to expand the production of solar, wind, geothermal, some small-scale hydro, and low-emissions bioenergy. And that's it. It's that simple. Yeah, did you have a question?
Well, no, you said sort of transportation is under energy efficiency, and that's taking up 40% of your greenhouse gases. So just by converting into
you mean going to clean renewable energy does not raise efficiency? Yeah, well, the two things will both happen. So we need to have, for example, automobiles should at least be, in 20 years, automobiles should at least be as efficient as Priuses are now, as an example. We should have more public transportation. We should have, organize the urban fabric in a more energy efficient way. We should have combined heat and power, heating and cooling systems. Those would be the kinds of efficiency investments that I'm talking about. And there's no reason that once you make those investments, then you still wouldn't run the equipment on the basis of solar energy or wind energy. Okay, and so, and then while we're expanding those sources of energy and raising energy efficiency, then obviously we substitute away from fossil fuels. And so what I will argue is that if you reduce fossil fuel, and I'm not just talking about coal here, I'm talking about coal, oil, and natural gas. I don't see natural gas as a bridge fuel, although it's cleaner burning than coal, but in the production of fossil fuels, the escaping methane gas makes overall greenhouse gas emissions from natural gas is roughly equivalent to coal. So we've got to get out of them all. Realistically, I think a figure of an absolute decline of 35% by 2035, or at a rate of about 2.2% a year. And if we do that, as I'm going to show, you can basically get emissions, global emissions, down from where we are now to 20 billion tons CO2 emissions. And the other part of it that's critical is that this is a positive investment program. I know we want to talk about military spending, and that's important. And there's an important lesson with military spending that can be applied here. Whatever we may think about what's being done with the production of military spending, we always hear that military spending is necessary because it's good for jobs. Can't cut military spending because cutting military is bad for jobs. Well, the point is, if you invest in alternative things, you don't. It's not that it's military spending that's creating the jobs. It's that you're in doing new investments. You invest in anything, you create jobs. And what I'm going to show you in a bit is that investing in the green economy is actually a net positive source of job creation in comparison with sustaining a fossil fuel economy. It's a major source, engine of job creation in any country setting that I've studied. And I've studied a lot of countries. The other part, so the arguments against taking action on climate change is that it's bad for jobs and it's bad for economic growth. And there is no reason why this scenario, this investment scenario, should be seen as bad for economic growth. It is fully consistent with any kind of healthy growth path. And that's what I want to show you. Okay, so just so you believe me, and I'm not going to go through all the details, what I'm looking at, though, the average costs of energy efficiency, how much does it cost to gain a unit of energy efficiency? And by energy efficiency, I'm distinguishing that from conservation. Conservation means we are doing with less. Okay, so we can do with less. But for the most part, I'm not assuming we have to do with less. I'm assuming that we have better insulated buildings, we have better lighting, we have more efficient cars, we have more public transportation. Those are the sources of energy efficiency. So we are not sacrificing the benefits we get from using energy to operate machines. We are just operating them way more efficiently. Now, how much does it cost to get a unit gain in energy efficiency? Well, these are some different estimates, and they range extremely widely. And what I'm looking at is the investments that it costs to reduce energy consumption by 1 quadrillion BTUs, British thermal units. And if we want to, what is a quadrillion BTU? Well, there's different ways. Well, one BTU, one British thermal unit, is you light a match and you burn it to the end, that's one BTU. A quadrillion BTUs is roughly equivalent to all the electricity that goes into lighting all the homes in Ohio and Pennsylvania. So just to give you a rough sense of what a quadrillion BTU is. Okay, now the World Bank has a number to save a quadrillion BTUs is going to cost $1.9 billion in new efficiency investments, and they're all for it. A second study, which looked at developing countries only, said, no, it's going to cost $11 billion to save a quadrillion BTU. And then the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, looking at buildings and industry only in the United States, says, actually, it's about $30 billion. So we have a range of $2 billion to $30 billion. Okay, now what I'm going to do for the purposes of our discussion, I'm going to assume it's 30. I'm going to take the highest number, okay? And we'll say, how much can we get in terms of savings? Okay, the next issue, the next foundation, as I said, investing in a green economy is renewable energy. And here's the story, the main story that is not well known, but people need to understand that the costs of delivering energy from wind power, from geothermal power, and increasingly solar, though solar is a little off, is at parity. It is at basic parity with fossil fuels. It's a matter of building it out. It's a matter, yes, we can improve the technology, and we will. But the existing technology delivers energy on average at rough parity. And this is a chart that comes directly out of a study from the organization called IRENA, which means International Renewable Energy Agency. So I basically lifted this chart. And if you look at the gray rectangle, which is running across the chart, what we're looking at, the cost of delivering a kilowatt of electricity through fossil fuel sources, okay? And the numbers on the vertical bar are cents. So we're looking at, that 0.1, that's 10 cents. We go up to 20 cents, 30 cents, 40 cents. So the range for fossil fuel energy in the rich countries is looking at about 7 cents to 12 to 13 cents. That's what we're looking at. Now, then all these colored bars, we're looking at the costs for different renewable sources. The first set is wind, then we have solar, then we have bioenergy, and the blue one is hydropower and geothermal. Now, without getting into a lot of details, the first bar we have, like the orange bar, the heavy orange bar, that's 2012 actual numbers, and then the second bar is 2020 projected. Now, with the exception of the purple bars, and that's solar, what we see is that, that's what I mean when I say we're at cost parity. With wind, bioenergy, hydropower, and geothermal, they're all within the range of that gray rectangle. That means cost parity. Now, it doesn't mean that every single site you go to, if you want to put up a wind turbine, it's going to be at exactly the cost of coal. That's not true. There's going to be more variation. We see there's more variation. But what we are seeing is that getting to a low-cost renewable energy source is not difficult in principle. The numbers are there. And this is evidence derived from observing actual renewable energy sites all over the world. Now, the solar is the purple one. The solar is higher cost. Though even with solar PV, the first two purple, we are within range. We're in the upper range of fossil fuels. But the other thing is that solar is coming down much faster. The costs of solar are coming down much faster. Solar promises to be, the dominant energy source over time is if we keep getting those bars down. So this is the basic story. Invest in energy efficiency, invest in renewable energy, and you will be able to supply energy at costs that are comparable with fossil fuels. And by the way, I'm not factoring in the environmental costs of fossil fuels at all. If we factored those in, of course, that gray rectangle would go up a lot. Okay, now I have a little model. I'm not going to go through the whole model, but just so that you know what I did. What I did is I said I took the International Energy Agency's own model of energy growth, emissions, and so forth, and I took their basic assumption, which was that let's assume that global GDP proceeds at about 3.5% a year. That's their number. I just took their number. I said, now let's take their global economy model, but now let's tack onto it. We're going to invest 1.5% of GDP per year, global GDP, beyond what's being invested now. We're going to take 1.5% and put it into renewable energy and energy efficiency. And we're going to cost it out at these high numbers. Like I said, the $30 billion per year to reduce, to get a 1 quadrillion BTU of efficiency gain. Okay? So we're going to do that. And then we're going to cost, because solar, I'm assuming, is expensive. I'm going to say the solar number is a high number for the U.S., $200 billion to get a quadrillion BTUs of solar, for example. That's basically the model, and that's it. And I'd have no nuclear energy, or no increase in nuclear energy. There's nothing about so-called carbon capture technology, if you've heard of that, the idea of burning fossil fuels and then capturing the carbon once it's released, converting that gas to a liquid, transporting it underground and storing it forever underground. I'm not assuming carbon capture is a viable technology. We have no evidence that it is. Okay, so if we depend entirely on investing in green energy and efficiency, what we do then get is we get emissions down to 20 billion tons, global emissions, by 2035. But it requires us to invest 1.5% of GDP globally every year. And right now we're investing about 0.3 or 0.4% of global GDP. So effectively tripling, quadrupling the level of investment in clean energy and energy efficiency and renewable. And this shows you per capita. It's the same thing. It's useful to think of it in per capita terms, especially, which I'll talk about at the end a little bit, in terms of environmental justice issues. Like, how much is every person responsible for? Well, right now, the average person in the United States generates about 17 tons of CO2 emissions per year. The average person in the whole world generates about 4.5 tons. And we need to get the 4.5 down to 2.3. If we're saying that the U.S., to be fair, the U.S. should go from 17 to 2.3. That's not going to happen. But that shows you the scale. In fact, I calculated in Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, the U.S. average is 17 tons per person. In Massachusetts, it's much better. It's more like 9. Yeah. So we're doing better, but we need to do... Okay. Now, what about... So I'm going to just talk about the impact on jobs, and then we'll talk about some broader issues on policy, and that'll be it. So first of all, on jobs, investing in energy efficiency and renewable energy is a major source of job creation. The reason is has nothing particular to do with greening anything. It has to do with the nature of the investments. They are more labor intensive than maintaining the fossil fuel economy. That is, it requires more people to retrofit a building or to manufacture solar panels than it takes to pump oil out of the ground and ship it, say, from Saudi Arabia to Western Europe. Okay, that's the first thing. The other thing that's also in this point is that it requires more domestic labor as opposed to imported labor. So for countries that are importing energy, it's a major source of job creation. So all this shows you are figures. These are figures for Brazil, China, India, Indonesia, South Africa, and the United States. The last row is looking at the increase in jobs relative to if you'd spent the exact same amount of money, the 1.5% of GDP, for example. In terms of jobs, you're going to get for Brazil, 75% more employment. For China, 79% more employment. For India, 103% more employment. For the United States, 135% more employment. So is this argument, which is, you know, a very powerful argument, you know, if you heard about the debate within the labor movement just last week about the pipeline in South Dakota, this is about jobs, you know, AFL-CIO endorsed the pipeline because they said it's about jobs. Well, overall, investing in the green economy will create twice, 2.5, 3 times more jobs. And it's true basically in every country that we've studied. And then if we think about countries that are actually oil importers, like Spain is a country I studied in depth. You not only get the benefit of the investments in the domestic economy, but you also get to reduce your imports. Okay, so the U.S. imports oil, but the U.S. also produces oil. Spain imports almost all its energy. So there's a huge benefit for any country that is heavily dependent on imports in terms of substituting out of imports and investing in their domestic economy. In fact, when I was in Spain about a year ago and talking about this, the big issue there, they want to hear about jobs, they want to get out of austerity. They're interested in this, but austerity is the dominant concern. And I said, well, this is an anti-austerity agenda because you are substituting out of imported oil and investing in the domestic economy. So it is a big, big source. So for example, I said generating about 400,000 new clean energy jobs. Now, another economic benefit from investing in the green economy is that you are able to create opportunities for small-scale production, for community production. Okay, so if you remember Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful. Well, this is Small is Beautiful in action. Okay, now, yes, you can have big wind farms and you can have big solar farms, and they exist. At the same time, what you get are opportunities for small scale, what are called distributed energy systems that are off the grid, that you can have a local grid. And these are sprouting up, not so much yet in the United States, but they're sprouting up primarily in Western Europe. And this is an opportunity. So even like if you have a grid, you can, for example, in Copenhagen, they have a big wind turbine right in the middle of the city, and it's distributed around the community. And in doing that, you also get away from the big corporate ownership model. So it creates opportunities for community ownership that don't exist otherwise. Yeah.
Isn't there also the factor of transporting it when it is not local?
Right. So yes, the transportation costs, and transportation even on the grid, electricity. You lose a lot in transmission, so you don't get those losses. Yes. Of the what?
It would cover the cost of the labor that are needed to...
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, so basically what I did was I just took the high-end estimates. I took the high-end, because I don't know, and obviously there's going to be a huge range. And there are people that have actually studied, project by project, how much these costs. So I just took the biggest number. Which doesn't mean it's the right one, but at least I'm not underestimating the magnitude of the problem. And so I put in the $30 billion per quadrillion BTU of saving. I said $200 billion on average to get a quadrillion BTU of renewable energy. And you run the model and you say, okay, the economy is growing at 3.4% a year. Every year, the GDP, I take out 1.5% and put it into green energy investments, and that's what you get. And then you can bring down emissions. Yeah, sure.
So the solar has been coming down in cost rapidly.
Right.
How is that affected in your model? How have you captured that in the model?
Yeah. Well, okay, so I was basically... Solar is the purple. Solar, photovoltaic is the two biggest purple lines, and you can see those are the most expensive. The other purple ones are concentrated solar power with or without storage. So I'm focusing on PV, And basically, when I say, you know, I took an average of $200 billion per to get a quadrillion BTU of renewable energy, I was weighting solar as being part of the mix, along with wind, bioenergy, hydropower, and geothermal. And but I took the high-end cost of solar and mixed it in with the others.
But it's been plummeting, so
that's, right. That's so my number is high. Yes.
Very high.
Yeah.
Continuing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it's definitely. Yeah. Well, this is what I deliberately tried to be conservative in the estimates. So I'm saying, you know, it probably we can do better than what I'm suggesting from out of this model. But I'm saying take conservative estimates. Yeah, solar is plummeting. Solar maybe in the last 5 years to generate a kilowatt of electricity has probably come down 70%. And you know the estimates are that you can lower costs by about 25% every time you double capacity. Now the fact is that the capacity of solar is globally tiny. So it's not that hard to double it. I mean, if you said the same thing about oil, that would be a lot harder to double capacity. But the solar energy is less than 0.5% of total energy supply now. So, but if we start investing in it, we will start to see a big cost savings because we'll build up the networks and we'll promote innovation. So yes, these are conservative, yeah. You mean did? Subsidies?
Energy invested in Portugal?
Yeah, subsidies.
What happened?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I forget what day, but there was a day last summer that in Portugal, the whole economy, the entire electrical grid ran on solar energy for one day. So yes, you know, the argument that's made in Spain and Portugal is that, you know, these subsidies are too expensive. And but look, they're looking at the accomplishments. They're building out a renewable energy system and they are substituting away from fossil fuels. So, you know, the subsidies are there and the only reason they look expensive is because in a context of austerity, we're saying, you know, these are the things we can't afford anymore. Okay, so now, you know, this all sounds all totally rosy, and then why is there any opposition at all? There you go. Power, money, and inertia. Okay. Well, you know, what's going on, like, for example, with the pipeline? These are real jobs. You're building the pipeline, they're real jobs. And if you say, we don't want to build a pipeline, then those people who are going to have those jobs are not going to have those jobs. That's a given. So when I say that it is a net source of job creation, which it is, that doesn't mean that everybody gets to keep the same job. That is not the case. Coal miners will lose their jobs. Okay, the coal industry is facing demise. And so what do we do about that? What we need to do is recognize this and provide what the late great labor leader Tony Mazzocchi termed superfund for workers as opposed to a superfund for dirt, and or what he called a just transition for workers who are going to face this transition of their industry facing demise. And so this has to be central because otherwise we'll never make any progress in developing the green transition because as we see, there's you know, powerful resistance. I'll talk about the business resistance in a second, but there is real resistance. And it is motivated by, you know, legitimate self-interest. Now, what I've tried to do in some research is to try to cost out what would be something like a reasonable just transition. In the United States, I had an article this summer in the American Prospect, and I have an academic paper that's just finishing on this. And you know, the numbers are pretty modest, actually. If we talk about job guarantees, moving the workers who are not retiring into jobs in the clean energy sector, if we talk about guaranteeing pensions for the workers who are going to be retiring over the cycle of, you know, say a 20-year investment cycle, and we talk about something like a reasonable community transition program, less than $1 billion a year. In the United States, I think, you know, this 1.5% of GDP for the United States would be in the range of $250 billion a year. So I'm talking about 1/250th of that to supply the just transition. And, you know, similar programs in other countries. I've done work, you know, in South Africa, Indonesia. You know, they have a big coal sector. There's a lot of jobs. So we have to provide a just transition. It has to be part of it. Now, oil companies, right. What's the just transition for oil companies? And I want to say, by the way, you know, if we're talking about oil, 90% of the world's oil is not owned by private companies. They're owned by state enterprises. Okay. But let's focus on the oil companies. Now, this a very useful organization in the UK called Carbon Tracker that tried to estimate the fossil fuels that are in the ground now that cannot be burned if there's any chance of stabilizing the climate. And what are those? What's the market value of those fossil fuels now? Well, it's $3 trillion. That's what they estimate, $3 trillion. Now, people that I respect have written articles that say, you know, $3 trillion. That is such a massive number that the only way that we can conceive of overcoming the resistance of the fossil fuel companies is something akin to the US Civil War. I don't agree with that. $3 trillion is a lot of money, but let me just put it in perspective. If we say that we're talking about a 20-year transition, the $3 trillion is going to go, but if we are able to spread out the losses over 20 years, that's $150 billion per year on a global scale. Global financial assets are total are $250 trillion. So we're talking about $150 billion as, you know, less than 1/1,000th of total financial assets. And by another comparison, during the financial crisis of 2008-2009, we households lost a lot of value in our homes. How much? $17 trillion. U.S. household wealth fell in 1 year by $17 trillion. Now, that was a huge hit, right? Now, we're talking about the fossil fuel companies losing $3 trillion over 20 years. They, of course, will resist it. Of course, who's going to give up $3 trillion? But this is a number that is manageable, and any kind of smart investor at this point knows it's time to move out of fossil fuels and into green energy. So that's why you have people like Warren Buffett hedging, and he put $30 billion into clean energy, and yes, he has about $100 billion in fossil fuel energy. But the point is that if we build a strong enough movement, and we build a divestment and reinvestment movement, and the case becomes overwhelming, then, you know, the arguments of the fossil fuel companies are going to melt away. Because, in fact, the number is large for them, but it is not large. It is not going to entail the collapse of the global economy. It's not. $3 trillion is absorbable, yes.
$3 trillion is in profits, and there's a certain amount that it takes on a per gallon basis to extract that. demand that it doesn't make sense to burn it because it's going to cost more than producing the solar power?
The $3 trillion is the value, yes, in the ground.
But that's not profits.
So right.
It takes money to extract.
That's right, yeah.
Your value from your solar is less than that, and there will be no market incentive to extract that $3 trillion of, you know, unburnable assets.
Yeah, well, except if you're the person that owns it, you still want to... Well, if you can sell solar for cheaper, yeah. And look, there have been a lot of other transitions. This is going to be another transition. You know, we transitioned out of rail travel and travel by ship to airlines. We transitioned out of landline telephones. We're doing that right now. So this is something equivalent to that, but it is not, huh? That what? I'm not saying it's good or bad, I'm saying it is. It's happened. And so it's a transition that this, we're talking about a transition on that scale. It is not on the scale of the Civil War. Yeah.
I'm trying to say this as concise as I can, and I hope that without my trying to prove it, that you will follow. The center of the U.S. economy is weapons production. Now, in the production of weapons, but the infrastructure in order to, you know, manufacture them, the labor, the resources, and marketing them globally. Now, people who are invested in that, who own all of that capital above the ground, are not going to agree to just destroy it. Also, politically, it's connected to the imperialist goals of the United States, and they are going to say, suddenly, let's just give up weapons production and selling. Don't mean they'll sell them to anybody. So I get very lost in your arguments that seem to ignore the real world that we live in, that where the weapons production is not only the economic source of profits for this economy, it is also the goal of the political system.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, I mean, my focus isn't on weapons. I could have talked more, and I think our next speaker... Well, it's also the case that the U.S. military is converting to renewable energy. And the U.S. military is going to be at 25% solar by renewables in 10 years. Yes.
Where is that documentary? In your book.
What does that mean by military? Does it mean the bombs that they're dropping all over Syria?
I'm saying that the operations, of the commitment of the U.S. military is, look, I'm not defending U.S. imperialism at all.
No, I'm trying to figure out how this very small thing of what's under the ground fits with what is actually going on in terms of producing.
Well, your point, I think, the point is that, yes, I mean, this transition out of a fossil fuel dominant energy system, a lot of U.S. imperialism has been about defending and supplying energy sources. Yes. Okay.
And we are going to be talking about that in a few minutes. So maybe
I'll wrap up.
You wrap up, yeah. And then there'll be other opportunities for us to talk about the whole thing.
So okay, good.
We'll have plenty of time to talk. But I want to give us a chance to...
Okay, I'll just wrap up real fast. So the only other major point I want to make, and I'll just give you also some stuff about Massachusetts per se. But one of the big points, which is why I gave you the... emissions per capita number, so that if you look, for example, at India, emissions per capita is about 1 ton per person, and in U.S. it's 17. So one of the huge issues is, well, what constitutes fairness here? You know, we've been dumping CO2 into the air for centuries, and India hasn't. And so this picture, is it fair that we should expect the poor countries to have to stabilize and go down? Well, my answer is India, for example, or China, for example, or Indonesia, for example, they can grow on the basis of green energy. They don't need fossil fuel energy. Now, what they do need is investment funds. So, yes. If we're going to get 1.5% global GDP, a lot of it has to go to be supplying energy, green energy, to poor countries. To me, that is the most practical way to develop a global system of fairness with respect to building the green economy. Yes, we do demand India, for example, convert to green energy, because if they grow at 6% on the basis of fossil fuels, India and China, that's what the world is going to look like. We can't have that world, but we can't ask them to stop growing. I won't. We can't. So what we say is you grow on the basis of green energy and we subsidize your energy, your development of the green energy system. Lastly, the program is simple. And then for Massachusetts, So Massachusetts, as I mentioned, and I'll just end on this, actually is doing well relative to a lot of other places, most every place else in the US. Maybe California is competitive. But you know, in 2008, we passed the Global Warming Solutions Act, which mandated reducing emissions by 25% relative to 1990 as of 2020. And that's all good, except even that is, you know, we're still going to be in the range of 9 to 10 tons per person, which is a high absolute number. And so that we need to accelerate the gains in Massachusetts. And I'll just mention this one other thing. The gains that have taken place since 1990, which are real, have been almost entirely through energy efficiency. So that's good in that it shows you the opportunities through improving transportation, buildings, and in industry efficiency levels. But it also means that we have a huge opportunity. There's almost no effectively, very modest renewable energy supply. It's growing, but from a very small base. So the opportunities in Massachusetts are real. The employment is there. According to the state agency, there's about 100,000 people that they identify as working in clean energy in Massachusetts. And, so it's already in the range of 2.5% of the workforce. So it's a growth area. And so we need to support it. That is to support investments like in the world at whole, renewable energy, energy efficiency, and contract fossil fuels. I'll end there. Thank you.